you know, I mean, there's a difference between having high social status and having high social status and using that social status to make other people miserable. Mm-hmm. So I think the former, that I think if people who don't have high social status look at those people, then you sort of, yeah, it's like their lives are perfect. It's easy. Things are easy. And those kids do not necessarily have it easy at all. They're just, a lot of them are just really good at hiding the struggles that they're going through, which is one of those things where, I mean, you know, I just feel like I have to say this because the research we're getting and the experiences I'm having as a teacher and an educator in around the country is so powerful, is that, you know, one of the things that's so infuriating about like the news clips when some young person has committed suicide is they always find somebody who says they just had a smile every day. I just never would have thought that this was happening, like all this stuff. And that's because young people are really good at showing up to school every day, feeling miserable and pretending that they're fine. And because we don't want to ask the hard questions, adults don't want to ask the hard questions that would get the answers of why young people are feeling so stressed and so miserable. You know, we're not really going to figure it out. If we don't have we literally do not have the strength and the courage and maturity to look at the questions, then we're never going to be able to handle this problem.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Rosalind, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So I was introduced to you by way of our mutual friend, Joseph Logan, who has been sending me a steady stream of incredible and amazing people that he happens to know. And when he told me a little bit about your work and your story, I was very intrigued. And given what it's about, I think this is a fitting question to start with. And that is, what social group were you a part of in high school? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
Well, actually, the most powerful social group I was ever a part of was in eighth grade. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot about the world, for better and for worse, in that group. So I was part of a very powerful group of girls in eighth grade, but I was the person in the group that, at least from my perspective, that could, you know, people would just relentlessly tease or would just feel like they could beat up on, and I wouldn't really be able to do anything about it. I didn't feel like I had any power in that group at all. I just desperately wanted to stay in it.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that end up influencing kind of the trajectory of your life and your career?
Oh, you know, not at all. Not one bit. you know, it's funny because, you know, lots of times in life you do things and then you look back and you only understand why you do things in retrospect. But at the time, you know, you've like no self-awareness about why you do the things that you do. So, you know, really, when I was starting my work, and I started my work at a very young age, at you know, the work I do now, it's all I've ever been doing. And so I started doing the work when I was about 21, and I started a nonprofit that would work on girls' self-defense. And sort of the path with that was that in high school, and it's connected to those girls, in high school, I dated this young man that I dated pretty much for all of high school. And for 2 years of it, it was, you know, sort of one of those kind of like sort of dysfunctional, but like married couple kind of like where people think it's really cute that like kids are dating. And there's still kids like that today in high school. But it got really problematic, and it actually got pretty abusive by the time that I was in junior and senior year. And he was really struggling with alcohol and drugs and family issues of his own. And he's gone on to do incredible work and to really reconcile, you know, the stuff that he did when he was younger. But the reason that I got into that relationship with this young man was because I had such low social status within the group of girls that I was friends with in eighth grade that I really needed a boyfriend. Like I needed a boyfriend sort of for an insurance policy that they would stop being so nasty to me. And it really felt to me like, and I, of course, like I couldn't articulate this at the time, but I definitely could feel what was going on. And I could see the changes that were happening and how people were treating me once I started dating this guy. Because my friends felt like they couldn't treat me as badly. You know, so by ninth grade, they were much, much nicer to me. And one of the reasons why was because my boyfriend had a lot of social status. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons that I was propelled into a relationship and why having a boyfriend was so important to me was because of the relationship and the interactions I'd had in eighth grade. So, you know, if you then move it forward of like, well, how does this influence the person that I became? You know, at 21, I'm trying to get through or and process having been in an abusive relationship for many years as a young person, as an adolescent and a very young woman. And I needed to figure out what I did that contributed to why I stayed in this relationship. And that doesn't mean I'm to be blamed. I don't blame myself. I never blame myself for like being in this relationship. But I really needed to feel like, okay, if I, my preference would be that I don't get back into this kind of a relationship. So what do I need to look at in myself that got me there? Mm-hmm. And it was at the, and so that was where I started looking back and saying, wait a minute, like those eighth grade girls that made it so important to me that I had that boyfriend. And then I took that and it became part of my identity, and then it became abusive, and it was incredibly difficult for me, like many, many people in abusive relationships, not just women, to leave that relationship because it was part of my identity. So all of that to say that the things that I learned in eighth grade really got me to a place where I was making really bad choices about the relationships that I was in. And I guess the quickest sort of soundbitey, and I you know, way to say it, but I mean it, is that the things you learn about relationships in middle school, about that the relationship or maintaining the friendship is more important than how the person is treating you within that relationship. Mm-hmm. That was like the real epiphany for me once I was really starting to work on this issue and really started to think about what were the quote unquote choices that people felt in relationships, and then it would get you to a place where you would, if you had developed this, you know, unfortunately, if you had developed this coping skill as a child or as a young teenager, that you would bring that with you into your intimate relationships. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, so for me, my life's work and my personal has always been intertwined. And so I think that one of those experiences in eighth grade were just, you know, just really powerful.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because for you, you know, obviously the social status was all about fitting in. I'm curious, why do you think it is that we value social status so much when we're young? Because, I mean, you'd mentioned, you know, the piece that I recently wrote on Medium, and I talked about this a little bit about, you know, being uncool and how exhausting it is to try to be cool. And I can tell you, I've wrestled with a lot of, you know, what you were experiencing in eighth grade and never really feeling socially accepted. And I'm just curious, you know, why do you think that as adolescents we value that so much? And what would you want parents who are listening to know about this?
Well, you know, so one of the things parents ask me a lot is, or no, they don't ask me a lot. Sometimes people will say to me, they're answering their own question. They'll say like, well, you know, these issues, you know, people sort of randomly come up to me and say like, you know, these issues, you know, the kids are dealing with, they've been dealing with it forever. And like, and the answer of course is, yeah, sure. They sucked then and they suck now. Mm-hmm. So, and they actually have long lasting implications into why the world is so screwed up. So saying that this is just the way it is never an actual answer. It's just a way to not be curious about how to change things. But I think that what's really important for parents and like, well, what is it, the drive? I mean, there's a couple different drives. Like we're all a combination of nature, nurture, and culture to some degree. Just like we all have some degree of privilege and some of us, you know, most of us have some degrees of privilege and some of us don't. But I think when we talk about middle school people, literally their brains, and the research about this is just more and more compelling, that they are literally physiologically going through a time in their life more than they ever will again of physically of being really focused on comparing themselves to other people, and that they physically feel the pain of rejection and physically feel the elation of acceptance. Mm-hmm. And when you say that to middle school people or people in their mid-range adolescents who are feeling this the most acutely, so you could be whatever age, one of the things that's been amazing to me is students will feel literally, you can see the physical relief. They will say like, I'm so glad you told me this. It makes so much sense, right? Like this feeling of rejection I'm having, like how could it be a physical feeling? And it is. And so there's that part, which is coming from their brain. But the other part is we live in a culture, our financial entire system is based on telling people and trying to sell people stuff and trying to convince them that they're not good enough, so they will buy certain things. And so the best and easiest, not the best, but the most efficient way to do that is to have messages coming at you that are telling you you're lacking and you're not good enough. And if you get certain things, then you will be, which therefore means that you are comparing yourself to other people. It's the basis of our entire financial and economic system. Mm-hmm. So we can debate the merits of that, the morality of that, and the ethics of that. But I don't think anybody can disagree that the basis of our wanting to buy, of this constant thing of buying things, is about trying to keep up. And the way in which we are sold things is feeling like we're not keeping up. Mm-hmm. And young people are on the receiving end of that just so incredibly significantly because of all the media that they're absorbing, just like all of us. But when it connects with their brain development and where they are, it's so powerful and so pervasive that it's really difficult for them to critically analyze what they're going through, which is why it is so important that they learn those kinds of things, like you talked about in your article, about like, what do you learn in school? Mm-hmm. You should be learning about what media literacy actually means. It should be that you need to be able to track what information is coming at you online. In comparison, it's hard sometimes for our core curriculum classes to, you know, you look at that and you're like, what is more important for a young person to know today? Knowing what information is coming at you and knowing why it is making you feel insecure is one of the most important things that we need to know how to do in today's culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's funny you say that, because I think that even as an adult, being 39-year-old, there are things that still make me feel insecure when I come across them in media. And some of it stems from, early age when I remember my parents not being able to afford things like a pair of Air Jordans, and you'd compare yourself to the kid who got them.
Right.
Like, why does that kid have them and I don't? And my dad being able to, my dad's only answer is, we can't afford that. And
right.
You're going to outgrow them within a month anyways.
Right. Exactly. And so now, boys are, shoe porn, like what they're following on Instagram, mm-hmm. is really important, right? It's a way of them having social status. And then there's so many boys wherever I travel, and I swear, not just in the United States, but wherever I travel, boys are obsessed about their shoes. And there's, always boys in a school or a community that's is entrepreneurial to a certain extent. And, swapping out his shoes and selling the shoes that he gets on eBay or doing all that stuff. He's trying to turn into a little mini mogul by, swapping the shoes and swapping mm-hmm. his Supreme shirts and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's funny you brought up boys. So that actually raises a question. What do you see as the differences in, what people crave in terms of social status between girls and boys?
As far as their social status goes?
Yeah, what are the differences in what they crave as far as their social status?
It's funny because, it's one of the things that I'm very self-conscious about, I guess, is that, my work, if from a superficial reading of it, is looks like it's very gendered. And I know that boys and girls run a spectrum of all different kinds of things. And rightfully, boys and girls of all ages can get really frustrated with me because, some do, because it's the way it sometimes is like, this is what girls do and this is what boys do. And of course, there can be really big differences that way. Having just said, and then I realized that I've just said, wherever I go, boys are following shoes mm-hmm. on Instagram. So I do understand, I do recognize the dichotomy. For girls, I think everything about sort of girl culture that I wrote about many, many years ago in Queen Bees and Wannabes is just, unfortunately, as much as we do have the spectrum of different ways in which girls can show themselves and, think about images, their own images, is that everything about girl culture, the most confined negative stereotype or only valuing girls for their body or their sexual objectification and their value that way, that everything about that has been completely ramped up and tweaked and more intense. And so, the constant need for girls to be perfect at everything. So there was always an issue for some girls about being effortlessly perfect. Mm-hmm. But now is that they have to be effortlessly perfect at everything. So, there's lots of, in the United States, for example, there's a program called the IB program, and it's really mm-hmm. popular with a lot of people, and there's a lot of merit to the program. which also does not take away from the fact that it is jacking up boys and girls, but girls' anxiety. It is incredibly stressful program academically, and all the adults seem to focus on in schools is how great it is because it's like so academically rigorous. And yet we have girls in unprecedented numbers, literally unprecedented numbers, who are suffering from mental health issues, depression, anxiety, and thinking about hurting themselves or thinking about killing themselves. And it's really about, one of the reasons why is this feeling of having to be relentlessly perfect at everything you do. So you have to have your social media super tight. You've got to have your academics super tight. You've got to have your athletics super tight. Everything has to be perfect. And so for girls, that chasing of social status and chasing of things, I think, is oftentimes tied to the ways in which they think they have to have their, you know, they just have to have it going on like all the time. Mm-hmm. For boys, I think that they can be, it's a little bit more nuanced, which is that boys in our culture still feel like they can't say that they're trying really hard, or that they're passionately, they can be passionate about certain things with, and I talked about this in Masterminds when I wrote that book, about being passionate about making the world a better place. You know, like if you go to schools, the vast majority of kids are doing affinity groups about leadership or advocacy or like anything to do in schools with like, we're going to work together in a group to do something environmentally responsible, or we're going to support these kids because they have less resources or anything like that. Most of the time, girls are the people that are running those programs, because boys culturally still feel like they can't want to show their passion for making the world a better place. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they can be extremely passionate about the names that they come up with their fantasy football teams. And they come up with some really, really funny names. I will grant you that. But like when we're talking about passion and about social status and like what are they allowed culturally to do and what they're not allowed to do, you know, I think boys really, it's tough for both boys and for girls. And the thing that drives me bonkers and always has, but it's just like more and more makes me like want to beat my head against the wall, is the adult hypocrisy of like, and the refusal to actually acknowledge what we do that contributes to their craziness and what we do that refuses to actually give them the information that they actually need to be functioning members of our society. And then when they screw up, we blame them. Mm-hmm.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Sunbasket. For a lot of us, a delicious home-cooked meal is the ultimate luxury. It sounds so simple, but with all the planning, shopping, and kitchen knowledge required, not to mention all the time, we're lucky if we can pull it off once a week. Well, now you can get healthy, delicious meals on the table with Sunbasket. Sunbasket delivers a meal prep kit right to your door, making it easy to cook healthy meals that are convenient for any busy lifestyle. They use organic and clean ingredients. They have 18 healthy options to choose from every week, suitable for many lifestyles. Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much experience you have in the kitchen. And you can go to the Sunbasket app and pick from over 18 weekly recipes. You can easily cook dishes like seared albacore tuna steaks with green beans and soft cooked eggs or steaks with chimichurri and harissa or sweet roasted potatoes. They have paleo, gluten-free, lean and clean, vegan, Mediterranean, family options, and a whole lot more. And they work with the best farm and suppliers to bring you fresh, organic produce and responsibly raised meats and seafood. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep, and you can get a healthy meal and a delicious meal on the table in just about 30 minutes. So go to sunbasket.com/creative today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. Again, that's sunbasket.com/creative for $35 off. Again, that's sunbasket.com/creative. So, you know, one other question I have about this, and I was thinking about this morning as, you know, I was thinking about, you know, how this article that you mentioned turns into a book. And for some reason, the thought crossed my mind of, you know, the prettiest girl in class in eighth grade. And I wondered what it would be like to call her and ask her, did you know that every single kid, you know, me included, had a crush on you? And what misperceptions do you think that people have about your own social status? So I'm curious, for people who didn't have high social status in, you know, a junior high situation, what do you think that they have as misperceptions about people who did?
Oh, well, I think that they, you know, that their lives were like mythologically perfect. Yeah. That they had mythological power, that life was easier for them. You know, I mean, there's a difference between having high social status and having high social status and using that social status to make other people miserable. Mm-hmm. So I think the former, that I think if people who don't have high social status look at those people, then you sort of, yeah, it's like their lives are perfect. It's easy. Things are easy. And those kids do not necessarily have it easy at all. They're just, a lot of them are just really good at hiding the struggles that they're going through, which is one of those things where, I mean, I just feel like I have to say this because the research we're getting and the experiences I'm having as a teacher and an educator around the country is so powerful, is that, you know, one of the things that's so infuriating about like the news clips when some young person has committed suicide is they always find somebody who says they just had a smile every day. I just never would have thought that this was happening, like all this stuff. And that's because young people are really good at showing up to school every day, feeling miserable and pretending that they're fine. And because we don't want to ask the hard questions, adults don't want to ask the hard questions that would get the answers of why young people are feeling so stressed and so miserable. We're not really going to figure it out. If we don't have we literally do not have the strength and the courage and maturity to look at the questions, then we're never going to be able to handle this problem. So, you know, for me, if you're looking from the outside in, I think what's most important is to think about that just because something looks good doesn't mean it is. Mm-hmm. And then the people who do abuse their power, my experience with that is there are some people who, first of all, apples sometimes do fall far from a tree. It's not like parents necessarily are evil and then they have evil children. Sometimes there are really, really nice parents who have like kids who are just going through a really, really, you know, sort of hard time being decent human beings. And those parents are completely embarrassed by how their kid is behaving and don't know what to do about it. And it's way harder to actually fix the problem than when you're in the problem than when you're advising from the side, say it that way. Mm-hmm. If you're on the outside, I think that understandably wanting revenge is totally absolutely understandable. But I also think that we often think like, oh, that person was insecure and so they just took it out on other people. I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. But they made other people miserable and that doesn't give them an excuse. So, you know, if you're on the outside in, I think it's the feeling of, yeah, they could have had a crappy life. They could have had a crappy home life, but it never gives them an excuse to treat you terribly. Because mm-hmm. I don't want people getting off the hook because they had a bad home life.
Mm-hmm. A couple other questions. One is, you know, are you a parent? And if so, how has this influenced your own parenting? Two, you live in Colorado, so I feel like it would be irresponsible of me not to ask you about school shootings and kind of, you know, how sure. your perspective and your work has informed that. What's our path out of that? Because, I mean, it seems so tragic yeah. that is the point that we've reached where this is happening.
They're pulling. I mean, I already was getting on my, like, so I could feel my soapbox getting on my, and then I have to put myself down. No one wants to listen to somebody on a soapbox. What was the first question again?
Are you a parent and how has this perspective influenced your own parenting?
Yes, indeed, I am a parent. And it's been very tricky. I have a 14-year-old son who's literally about to turn 15, I think, next week. And then I have a son who just turned 17. It's a truism that people who teach on these issues are not necessarily going to know what to do with their own children. And it's also a truism that, you know, that just because you do this for a living, whatever that means, right? Like psychology or whatever. I'm not a psychologist, but if you work with young people, that your kids will be immune to these problems or being jerks themselves. Like, yeah. Absolutely not. Like, my kids have been in messy situations. They've both been perpetrators. They've been bystanders and crappy stuff that I'm embarrassed that they didn't do anything about it. They've also been targets. My older child was really targeted in elementary school. And I'm actually working on an article with him right now that we're doing together because he was, he looked much older at a very young age. And he always looked 2 or 3 years older. He was taller. And so you would think, well, he's taller and bigger, so kids would leave him alone. But that was actually the opposite. They went after him. And then the other thing that happened is that adults would either treat him with way more respect that he deserved, basically, and meaning like they would treat him with more authority. And or they would get really aggressive with him really fast. So, I mean, he had horrible experiences with adults growing up that were just astounding about, like, how fast adults can behave so immaturely when they think that they have the right to go after a kid. So my kids have been, I mean, my kids have gotten in trouble. My kids have done, you know, they've used words. I make a distinction between bad words. As a parent, I don't care really if my children use drop an F-bomb once in a while. I don't care if they use, you know, like bullshit or whatever. I think my son used it at dinner last night. Like, I don't care about that. Like, really, if I'm going to pick my battles, which is what parenting is about, I do not care about those words unless, you know, for the most part. But I really care about them using words that are homophobic, that are racist, that are sexist. And those are the words that I'm absolutely unequivocally get, you know, forbid. Does that stop my children from using the word bitch sometimes to talk to their friends? No, it doesn't. And I'm sure they've used, I mean, it's been a real, just to name one, that's been a real ongoing issue. Or my kids have seen terrible things at school and they've said, hell no, am I intervening? And I've had to work on, you know, my initial reaction is to get super aggressive with them, but that doesn't work. And so I guess as a way of saying it overall is that it's that parenting gives you a constant opportunity to self-reflect on are you effective as a communicator, and being able to be mindful of like how you handle yourself, because, you know, sometimes when my kids do something, I really get so angry that I lose myself. I'll tell you a specific story. My younger son used the word feminazi in an Instagram post to my sister. I found out about this while I literally was teaching on this issue at a school in Canada. I'm driving home exhausted from an end of day working at school. My sister calls me, who's, you know, she's like this awesome aunt, you know, sort of fabulous, trendy, like Brooklyn awesome aunt. And she said to me, I had put that, that my younger son had posted this comment on her Instagram thing. And she took the post down. She called him. I think she screamed at him. And then she called me to tell me. And I was so angry because we've talked to my son about like what feminism means. We've talked to him about what Nazism is. Like, we've talked to him about actually the meaning of words, that those words actually don't even fit together. We've talked to him about what the political connotations of that are. We covered it. And yet he still used that word. And I was so angry that I decided that, and I shot off a text that I shouldn't have done. Like, basically, you have shamed me and our entire family. Like, it was definitely like, shouldn't be like, really angry, really heavy. And then I realized that what I was doing was not going to work. And so I called my husband. And my husband and I very quickly decided that I was too reactive to this and that he was going to take this entirely, this conversation. So we sat down with my son and walked through again why was this a big deal? What was going on with him and what our expectations were? And then late that night, I was able to calm myself down, and I was out of town at the time, and I talked to him. And the first thing I said to him was, just talk to me about the conversation you had with your dad. And because it was coming from my husband, who feels passionately about this, but doesn't have the same timber of like rage that I do about this, that he was able to listen to it much better. And I was able to take a moment and realize, when am I effective and when am I not? And if it had not been my child, I would have been 1,000 times more able to have that conversation. I wouldn't have had that tone of rage in how I was speaking, but I was with my son. And so that's the moment of like, for parenting, of like, when am I being effective and when am I not? And when is my emotions hijacking the situation so that I cannot achieve the goal that I want? And then be able to, not necessarily a spouse, because some people don't have spouses who can do this or don't have them at all, but to have a support mechanism of people that your son or your daughter likes and cares enough and has a relationship with, that they can get on the phone or they can reach out and say, come on and talk to me about what happened. Because I just know that sometimes as a parent, because you are so intensely, ironically, because you are so intensely committed to this person, that you are not the person to be able to handle the situation well. And I, that's for me as a parent, constantly I'm having to, I am constantly given the example that I need to step back. And I'm way better working with other people in general than I am like with my own kids. So it's, you know, and now you're asking me about Colorado, by the way, right now.
Yeah.
Because I just want to say that I'm in my office looking at a group of young people who are smoking pot outside of my window, just so you know.
Yeah.
Just so you know, just to make it real for people.
Yeah.
And that's actually not common for me. It's not common for me to have this experience, but I literally, my office faces the street and I'm watching five people at about, I think they're like 16 or 17, who are all standing around on one of the major streets of Boulder and smoking, which is really not even like vaping. It's like, it's totally old school.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Squarespace. It's the beginning of the year, and chances are that you have a creative project or idea that you want to get off the ground this year. Whether it's writing a book, starting a blog, or building a business, Squarespace can help. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks, and everything is optimized for mobile out of the box, and they have built-in search engine optimization and 24/7 award-winning customer support. A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code UNMISTAKABLE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I brought up Colorado is, you know, I really would be curious to hear, you know, your perspective on school shootings, given, you know, the nature of your work.
Yeah.
I'd imagine you have a lot to say about this.
Oh, you know. I mean, so I have a lot to say. Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I think, I don't know if people realize this, it's true around the country, but I only moved here 5 years ago, and that was, I'd grown up in DC. And one of the things you realize living in Colorado, and more to the point, working in schools in Colorado, is that when you walk in, you realize that so Colorado has grown significantly, even since I've been here, but in the last decade. And so the schools, there's a lot of new schools. And what you realize is when you walk into these schools is they've all been designed with school shootings in mind. So a lot of schools are built basically in the shape of an H, and that means that they can shut off a portion of the school with double-sided, double-locked doors at any moment. And that, you know, more than like walking into a school and having to be buzzed in and go through a double set of doors and then talking to the person, you know, to sign in and whatever, which is pretty much standard now at all schools. For some reason for me, walking in when I first moved here and realized that that's the way that the schools had been designed around the belief that school shootings would happen at the school, was really, it just hit me really hard. And I had grown up in DC and worked in DC, where a lot of the schools, like in DC proper, where the schools are old buildings, they've been redone, but they're old buildings. And so they don't have that kind of sensibility to it. So, and all the kids know why, and it's pretty common, you know, and I do too, you know, when I'm in schools, like drills about shooter, you know, first person responding, you know, kids have to go through this a lot. So there's so many ways to respond to that, which is number one is that it's become normalized as part of a young person's belief, you know, of like schools. And also I'll never forget my older son, both of my kids are athletes, like pretty high status kids themselves. And I will never forget my older son saying to me, you know, just in passing, he said to me, well, mom, like I always make friends with the kids who are like, the kids that I think might be sort of scary, because like if they shoot up the school, I want them to like me. And I said, like, really? That's what you're actually making that decision? He's like, yeah, of course. Like wherever I go, I want to make friends with the kids that like, I think maybe if something goes wrong, I want them to know me and like me. And that is a normalization of violence, and also of an assumption that this is a reality, is something that I just think we need to really absorb. Like, what does that really feel like? And then the other part that I know, and I mean, it's an old book, but you know, it's 10 years old, but the book Columbine is one of the best research journalism books I think that's ever been written. And I think it speaks to how we got this false narrative of what school shootings are about with the trench coat and, you know, what was, you know, and this kind of thing that was happening, that these kids were bullied, and that this then started this whole bullying industry because we were all afraid that somebody was going to come in and shoot up the school. You know, what we know is that one of them was a psychopath and one of them was really, really clinically depressed. So so here's the issues. The issues for me are that we will not give young people the resources they need for mental health issues, that we allow adults in schools to abuse power way more often than we're willing to admit, and or that when there is any kind of abuse of power, peer-to-peer or adult-to-peer, to young person in a school, that there's a lot of adults who see the abuse happening from adult to kid, but they don't know what to do about it. And then one of the dumbest and most common things that we say to kids in schools is, if you are being bullied, go tell an adult. As if that is a simple thing to do, as if that is not a risk for the child, as if this is like, this is what you should do, as if all adults are competent at being able to handle these things, as if all adults don't abuse power. And the reality is that young people from their coaches and from their teachers are either seeing abuse of power or experiencing it themselves, or see a well-meaning adult, see another adult abuse power, and they do not know what to do. And so there's this whole context about school shootings that, of course, has very little to do with, of course, easy access to guns and to this kind of isolation or feeling and not giving resources to young people about mental health and not recognizing the actual dynamics that lead to the majority of kids feeling so desperate and so out of their minds that they are bringing guns to school. So, and then I know, because I work in all different kinds of the country, so I get this, is that I know, and my husband owns guns, the person I work with owns guns, grew up my, you know, hunting, all this stuff. I get this. I'm surrounded by people like this. None of those people that I hang out with that own guns are saying, oh yeah, we should give free access to guns to all people at all times, or like any kind of reasonable background check is unreasonable. The people that I know, especially, you know, in Colorado, people that I am interacting with are responsible people who believe that these things should be responsibly controlled. So it is amazing to me that we will not have honest conversations about it. And I would agree, and I think people have said this, that after Newtown happened, if we are not willing to put reasonable gun restrictions after six-year-olds have been killed, then we are not willing to do it. And it is one of the great, I believe it is one of the greatest like shames collectively and frankly individually in the country that we should be facing, is that we actually had this experience, and then we allow our politicians to say, we and our president, our 45th president, to say, we need to recognize, like, you know, respect to people's tragedy and their feelings right now, so we can't talk about this issue, is the most disingenuous, ridiculous conversation. So if we really have the integrity and we have the honesty and we have the courage and we have just like the responsibility to community that we say we're supposed to be about, then we would have these conversations, but we don't. And so, you know, when we do this, we're isolating kids and we're creating situations where it gets that much more likely that they're going to have the access to the tools to make their desperation so much more miserable for everybody else and themselves.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's do this.
It's just something I feel like slightly strongly about.
I can
right?
see that. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit. And I want to talk about, you know, the early part of your career and how it's gotten you to now, specifically how you go to writing a book like Queen Bees and Wannabes, and that, of course, being turned into a movie that we'll talk about, which most people have probably heard of. Walk me through that trajectory. Like how that all happens.
The trajectory of writing Queen Bees and Wannabes?
Yeah, like from the early part of your career to getting to that point, to the point of it being turned into a movie.
Yeah, so, you know, I struggled, from 22 to like, I don't know, 28, 29, I was running a nonprofit that was doing basically what I'm doing now. And then I wanted to write a book. I'd written a book when I was 25 that like very few people read called Defending Ourselves, because I was very involved in martial arts at the time and self-defense. And I was teaching that a lot. So I wrote that book, and then but I was still working on the work, you know, this work about like relational aggression and friendships and what was going on with girls. And I was also working with boys too in equal numbers, but it really felt to me like people did not understand what was sort of this world that seemed very obvious to me. About why girls were doing the things they were doing. So I decided, you know, I had a title in my mind because I was writing curriculum and lesson plans, saw that Queen Bee and Wannabe stuff was coming to me anyway. And so I decided to write a book, and I was 29, I think maybe 29, something like that, when I was starting to write the book. And then I also got pregnant with my first child. And so Queen Bees, I wrote Queen Bees and Wannabes when I was pregnant and the first 3 months of my older son Elijah's life. And I was already doing some media and you know, in various ways, but what happened is that a New York Times reporter followed me the year before, 6 months, 9 months before the book was published. And then that became a cover story for the magazine. And then Tina Fey read that article, and that article actually, if there was anything that like changed my life, that was it, because sort of everybody, it became this like zeitgeisty thing as soon when it hit, when it was on the cover of the New York Times magazine. And so my whole life shifted, not just because of the movie stuff, but because like my whole life shifted pretty much overnight as soon as that article came out. And it became this issue that everybody wanted to talk about. And what was hard for me was that I wrote about Queen Bees and Wannabes because I didn't want people to say like, oh, she's this and she's that and that kind of stuff. It was actually the opposite. What I wanted to do was create a language so people could figure out the behavior they were seeing so that we could get people to a better place. But people love, you know, for better and for worse, people love pigeonholing and labeling things. And labeling can be powerful because it can describe behavior, but also can be really limiting because it can really put somebody in a box. And I'm actually completely against putting people in boxes. What I am very much for is trying to understand behavior and putting some names to it so that we understand the behavior. So book comes out and I'm just sort of overwhelmed by being a new mom and handling the amount of attention that was going on, and then started getting a request to buy the rights to it for a movie. And I said no, like several times, four times, something like that. And then Tina Fey had a, she had a, like she needed to write a screenplay and she didn't know what to do it about. And so she read the article and she was like, well, this seems like something I could do. And so she, you know, it was, and nobody was super famous then. Nobody, you know, Mean Girls it was pre Mean Girls, if you can believe that. And she just like, I have to write this screenplay and I think maybe I should do it with you. And so, you know, I talked to her a couple of times and I was like, well, you know, this seems like a smart woman, somebody that, you know, she's my age, like we get along. She has my sense of sarcasm and whatever. So sort of my sensibility about feminism and about sort of self-accountability, rights, responsibility, just my sort of sensibility. And what I mean by feminism is, because remember, I have two boys that have dealt with lots of girls. They have dealt with girls saying feminism means girls are better than boys, which of course is a crack, is totally ridiculous and a stupid definition and wrong definition of feminism. Feminism is about having a critical lens to look at different kinds of privilege in the world, including gender. And so it's, so just, you know, sort of similar sensibilities. And, you know, I gave her the rights to do it. And we were sort of off to the races. Like 18 months later, Mean Girls came out. Literally 18 months after I had probably my first conversation with her, Mean Girls was in theaters.
How can companies and organizations do unmistakable work? Well, there are a few ways, but it involves going outside the regular standard operating procedures, and that scares companies. In a culture of uniformity, it's intimidating to choose to stand out, but I really do believe that creativity is one of the most underutilized assets in most companies, and this puzzles me because creativity applied in business directly translates into innovation. Speaking is one of the few avenues where I get to share these ideas in person rather than online. Think my message might be a good fit for your event or organization? Get in touch at unmistakablecreative.com/speak. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/speaking.
Lots of questions.
Never happened.
Well, lots of questions, as you might imagine. One, you know, what
What did you learn from working with somebody that is really kind of at this point a master of their craft? You know, I mean, Tina Fey is pretty much a household name, and you know, as far as comedy goes, she's iconic at this point. So I'm curious what you learned from her.
I'm going to tell her that she's now iconic, that we're so old that you now put these words to it. That's so funny. Oh, we're so old. So, cause we were in our, you know, I was what, 31. So she's, you know, she was 30, whatever I was, she's 2 years younger than I am. So 31, 30, 29, whatever it is. So let's see. How was it like? What was it like? I mean, I tend to want to work with people that are smart and don't take themselves too seriously. And, you know, I try and align myself with men and women who have those characteristics. And I've never really thought about, you know, I mean, I work with teenagers all the time. So my bullshit, I have zero tolerance for like people being like, hey, you know, I'd like to do this with you. I'm like, no, absolutely not. So I just, I don't know. It just, it felt like a natural decision to me of like, if I was going to do this, then this seems like the right person to do it with. I'm like, I'm doing that today. I actually, to tell you the truth, same reason, although we haven't come out with anything yet, cause there's been various dramas around it. But, I have dear friends, Sean Anders and John Morris, who wrote, who are one of the writers on We Are the Millers and did Daddy's Home and, Sex Drive, I think was their first movie. And it was a similar thing where I sat in a room with, this time it was like, I sat in a room with them and they're funny and, smart. And, if they hear this, they're gonna be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe she said that we're smart. But you know, there was a similar sensibility of just like, these are smart, hardworking, funny people that I want to work with. So I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I'm just going to throw my lot in with them.
How was your, a couple of things. I'm curious, you know, as you've gotten older, and this is something I've been asking a lot of people, I think mainly just because of the fact that I'm getting older and it's been on my mind, you know, you've been commercially successful, in, you know, a creative career, and a lot of people, you know, often aren't fortunate enough to have that experience. I'm curious if your definition of success has changed over the course of your life.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's, well, gosh, that's like more and more hours of talking. So, I mean, one of the things that is a curse, it's a blessing and a curse for me, is that I never feel like I've reached a level of success. You know, I always feel like I have to, I never feel like I can let my guard down about doing things mediocre. If I feel that I've done things in a mediocre way, I have a really, really hard time with it. You know, so my definition of success when I was younger was definitely very similar to what we talked about in the beginning about comparing myself to other people. And that was really hard for me. Now, was it a driver for me to get things done? Sure, it did. But as I've gotten older, my definition of success is that I feel like the integrity of the process, there's more focus on the integrity of the process. And feeling like I truly did the best I could in the process of self-reflection and putting together something that is really reflective of like where I am right now. And the comparison stuff, I mean, I still have the comparison stuff. Like I haven't put out a book, and I had a curriculum come out last year, end of 2016. I have a book that I really, really want to write. I'm hugely working in schools to do systemic change for schools so that this issue of young people being able to trust adults around abuse of power, that we do something about that. So I'm pouring all of my energy into this program called Owning Up that we're doing in schools around the country and some internationally. And I'm really busting my butt. And yet I still feel like, oh, I haven't done this article for this. I haven't done that. I haven't done this. I haven't written the book. Oh my gosh, if I don't write this book, then I'm not going to be able to compete with my peers. Like all of this stuff still runs in my head. But I guess, I mean, I don't guess. I feel like I try harder to process the impact of that on the quality of my life and how I would define success. So, and to forgive myself a little bit that I can't write a book, keep up with writing articles, travel around the country doing all these conferences and speaking to kids, and be home for basketball practice. Where, you know, I bust my butt to get home so I can take my kid to basketball practice. And, you know, I get like every other parent gets. I get like, oh, hey, mom, what's up?
Yeah. You know, I want to finish with two questions, you know, and I think it kind of brings us full circle because, you know, we alluded to the article that I wrote. Why aren't we teaching, why isn't this more common in our schools, and why don't we teach this stuff in our schools, the things that I was talking about in the article?
Oh, because, so with the funny meaning, incredibly frustrating, curl your hair out stupidity that schools cling to, is that individually, if you ask the vast majority of administrators and teachers what young people need, they will say that young people go to school and stay in school and want to be in school and do well because of the relationships that they form in schools with a well-meaning, passionate adult who cares for them. They will say that it is not about standardized tests and it's not about teaching to the test. And they will talk about that. And they know that that is the reason, that they know it. And yet when we get into a group, when educators get into a group, we default to this kind of thinking. And it's also very, it's also way too common in schools that we get away with saying things like, well, I just have to teach the test, or, you know, I just get all these things that, you know, for teachers to say that, which some of them are, I'm not, there's two things that are true. One is that teachers have a ridiculous course load and they are constantly being evaluated. And one of the things that we talk about now a lot in schools is about growth mindset. That's what people love growth mindset now for very good reason. And if you don't know it, it's basically like, I'm not good in math. You don't say I'm not good in math. You say I'm not good in math yet. And that's the way that we're trying to talk to young people about their skills and their capacities. And yet we never, ever, ever talk to teachers in that way. Teachers are constantly being evaluated, and or if they're not, or once in a while they're being evaluated, but they're being evaluated arbitrarily, and there's no growth mindset for the educators who are actually teaching it. So teachers feel like they're basically about to fail all the time, or they're going to fail. They're being given a test that they can't, that they're not given the resources to do well on that test. They're getting set up for failure. Like, oh, hi, 28 kids and 14 of them have individual learning plans because they have learning differences. And we've got these kids over here who, I mean, it's just on and on. And we're not going to have meaningful or common sense cell phone rules. So the kids are going to be, you know, looking at porn under their desks all day. And you're not going to be able to handle it well because we're not going to give you rules that enforce that well, because we don't want to admit that kids are looking at porn on their phones. So in fact, what we'll do instead is we're going to give them a one-to-one Chrome tablet, because we believe that every child needs to have a technology in their hand, because that's like, without actually giving them the rules to be able to to be able to behave on those Chrome tablets well, the thing that we will do is we will have a cyberbullying assembly that we're going to tell all the kids things that they already know and with really unrealistic ways, and then they're going to go back into their classes and use their cell phones and look at porn. So it's the way in which teachers have to deal with what the situations are is literally laughable. At the same time, it's really hard to be able to hold, in some ways, teachers accountable for bad behavior. And so when you ask the question of why are we not doing things that are common sense, it's because we're too afraid to have the questions and to change in a way that make this respectful to teachers' experiences and responsibilities, and it is respectful to young people's experiences as well. And that's, I believe, why, like from a meta, like kind of larger context, like why we don't do that. So one of the things, for example, that I've been saying to teachers around the country is, so if Instagram's a really big deal for your kids and they're really focused on their followers to following ratio, when you're in middle school and you need to teach ratios, why don't you teach it through that of like, up your Instagram accounts, look at people's Instagram accounts, and we're going to teach you about followers to following ratio we're going to teach you ratios based on that. Or we're going to teach you about all different kinds of things that are related to, we can do core curriculum classwork and do it in a way that makes sense. And the thing, just to back up your article, is that when I ask young people, what do you want to learn about? The thing, you know, like in their like sort of life skills classes or whatever you want to say, whatever you want to call it, the thing that they want to hear about is they don't want to hear about bullying and cyberbullying because it's so stupid the way that people talk about it. And but what they want to talk about is healthy relationships, how to tell a friend that's actually like a good friend of yours, like how do you tell if somebody is a good friend? How do you change a tire? And what is it about credit cards? Like, how does it work? How do credit cards work? How do you apply for credit cards? Do you have to pay for it? How do you pay for it? that's four things, the most common things that kids are telling me they want to know.
Wow. So I want to finish.
Which, by the way, shows how smart they are. Because if the majority, if people in this country knew the answer to those four questions, we would be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. Wow. Well, I want to finish with one last question, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I was thinking about this, but this is a very tough question. unmistakable means that you, to me, is somebody, it's a two part for me. One is that you're able to laugh at yourself, but that you're able to laugh at the things I was thinking about it and I overthought the question. It's that you are able to laugh at yourself and also take big things seriously. So, this is another hour conversation, but this whole thing about being politically correct is a really interesting conversation and one that I have with young people all the time, because we need to have really important dialogues with people in uncomfortable ways. And safe doesn't mean you don't have uncomfortable conversations. But so for me, it's being able to be self-reflective, laugh at yourself and laugh at how absurd things can be, but also take things that are like people's dignity and the things that are big things, take them seriously and be able to stand up for those things. For me, that makes somebody unmistakable.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting end to our conversation. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and insights with the listeners. This has been phenomenal. Where can people learn more about your work?
So it's culturesofdignity.com. Uh-huh. And if you want to look at the curriculum, actually, that I referenced, it's also that also can be found on owningup.online. But our website is culturesofdignity.com.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.